started at John Staten's suggestion, thinking about what Jesus taught during the period of time between when he was raised up and when he ascended to heaven. And we have considered his appearance to the women on the morning when he was raised up, then his walk in the country with the two disciples on the way to Emmaus, and then his appearance to the 11 minus Thomas during the evening of that day when he was raised up, and then his appearance again when Thomas was present and his talk with Thomas. Tonight we're thinking about the one of the resurrection appearances which is maybe most debated in what it means. I'll put it that way. There are some students of the Gospel of John who treat this chapter as if it's sort of an add-on, and even have debated whether it belongs a part of the story. I, of course, am convinced that it does, and I want to make that known to you. And then we've heard discussions of different paragraphs in this great chapter, the meanings of the word for love and his talk with Peter along toward the latter half of the chapter, and then the rumor about what would happen to John and John's old age, and then whether this talks about the Peter being crucified upside down as tradition holds that he was, and so on. I take a different approach to this passage, and I don't mean to just set aside the other part, but I believe that Jesus is teaching something that's important in this passage. And I think the key to the whole thing is found in verse 3. I believe when Simon Peter said to the other disciples who were present, "I'm going fishing," and when they said to him, "We'll go with you," that explains not only why Jesus appears to them now, but also the things he says to them. When the disciples get past the initial excitement and puzzlement over the news that tomb is empty, and when word has gotten around that he's appeared to some of them, and when they themselves have dealt with the shock of that at least a time or two now, and when they are turning their attention back to the mundane things of everyday life as if that had never happened and as if it was not going to have any bearing on what they did from then on, then the Lord steps in and the action of this chapter develops from there. This event happens at the Sea of Tiberias, also known as the Sea of Galilee and the Lake of Gennesaret or something like that. In this time, there are seven of the disciples present. Five of them are named, and that would be Peter and Thomas, Nathanael, and the two sons of Zebedee, and then two other disciples are present. This happens early in the morning as day is breaking. We're not sure exactly how long after the Lord's resurrection this was. It obviously is this is in Galilee now and not in Jerusalem, and there'll be time for them to go back to Jerusalem before he ascends back into heaven. But that sort of sets the stage. What does the Lord teach in this passage? Well, number one, I want to suggest four things, and we'll read the Bible together tonight. Number one, he teaches that there comes a time when his disciples need to turn their attention back to the purpose for which he called them to start with, which is continuing his ministry, and especially which is being involved in being fishers of men. It does no good to know that Jesus was raised up and then not to say anything about it to anybody. It does no good to think he came to announce God's love for us. He came to offer himself up for us. God raised him up alive to prove that the work was done, and then to go on saying nothing about it. I want to take the latter passage here before I read the first part. I think the background to this is noteworthy. All the things we're about to read in the first part of John 21 have some things in common, details-wise, with Luke chapter 5. So if you look back there, verse 1 beginning, it says that on one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets, which, by the way, was a hard and messy job. Essential, though, or their fishing equipment would be destroyed. So it says, getting into one of the boats, which was Simon, he asked them to put out a little from the land, and he sat down, and that is, in the boat, and he talked to people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Simon answered, and you can hear the weariness in his voice in this if you think about it. Master, we toiled. Notice fishing was not for fun. We toiled all night and took nothing. In the English Standard Version, that statement is followed by an exclamation point. We worked all night and it did no good. But at your word, I'll let down the nets. And that statement is not followed by an exclamation point. He wasn't excited to do this. He was willing to obey the Lord in doing it. And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. And when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken, and so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. From now on, you'll be catching men. When they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. Now, with that in the background, how does it sound to you in John 21 when Peter says, I'm going fishing, and when the others said, we're going with you? Had they taken their minds at least for a minute off the idea of being anything but fishers for fish? Had they forgotten the business about doing what the Lord said? If you think about it now, come to John 21, and it says, after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And he revealed himself in this way, meaning that how he revealed himself is part of the point. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, or Didymus, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, who are of course James and John, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we will go with you. And they went and got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Do you see anything in common there with what happened before? Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet his disciples did not know that it was Jesus. In other words, they're out in the water enough that they can't see and tell the difference at this point. Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? They answered him, no. He said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. Does that sound familiar to you? So they cast it. Now notice in this case, they're not washing their nets. They're not at that point. They haven't given up yet. They're still out in the boat with the nets and fishing. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. like the other time, remember Luke 5, that disciple whom Jesus loved, and this is John, he refers to himself in this gospel this way so as not to name himself, but to show his affection for the Lord. Therefore said to Peter, it's the Lord. Now, notice in my reading of that, the point made in verse 1 about how Jesus revealed himself in this way, that would suggest that the manner of his making himself known conveys part of the lesson of this appearance. He does it in detail in these ways as if on purpose to remind them that it happened, something that happened 3 years or so earlier in the beginning of the Lord's ministry, and to remind them of an event when he told them they were going to be fishers of men, and of a time when they were so impressed with their sinfulness that his willingness to call them, to use them, their willingness to obey, to act at his word, was a crucial moment in the ministry of Jesus. Now that his ministry has been completed, and now that he's made the great sacrifice, and now that he's been raised up, he doesn't want them just to turn back to life as if none of it had ever happened. He wants them to now start giving their attention to what he set out to do to start with and what it meant. And that's important. Are there times in our lives when our attention kind of needs to be turned back to what our task is? The same telling the good news and building up those who are taught and caring for each other's hurts that occurred in Jesus' ministry when he went about doing good according to Acts chapter 10, verse 38 and following. To me, that's a great part of this story. The Lord taught his disciples that the time comes when you need to turn your mind back to what your task is and what your business is, what the Father's business is. Secondly, now in this passage, Jesus taught that when his disciples are serving like this, while they are serving, that he himself has fellowship with them and is able to provide for their needs to make it possible for them to carry on his ministry. Now, I put it up here in this way so you can think about it while we're discussing it. But notice in John 21 now, the story continues, and I'll read it, and then I want to call your attention to three or so details from this paragraph. It says, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place, with fish laid on it, and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you've just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Notice the contrast with Luke 5 in this way. Where that over there, the net was torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Now, I read this with a smile in some ways. Some of the commentaries spend the bulk of the time discussing the number 153. You wouldn't believe how many different ideas have been put forth about whether that number is symbolic or not. That kind of misses the point, doesn't it? There was a whole bunch of fish, and this detail was there by the word of an eyewitness. That's what I get from it. I think the point the Lord is making in doing this is to say to them, look, I still have control over the physical forces of my world. I'm still able to say where the fish are and to provide a haul for you when you act in keeping with my word. And I still am able to see to it that when people do what I ask them to do, they'll be blessed. Jesus is showing the connection between this event here and what happened earlier in his ministry in Luke 5, in that sense, he still is the same Jesus, and is still active in that way. Notice that he, in doing this, communicates the idea that he's going to be able to meet the needs that they may have. If they thought they had to go back to fishing in order to survive while they were waiting on being of any service to the Lord, they misunderstood. This event is teaching them that if he sends them to tell good news, he's going to provide what they need in that process. And then notice the significance of the breakfast meal. Remember when we were reading Luke 24 about the two disciples on the road to Emmaus? They recognized him when he blessed the bread and broke it. That was the moment they realized who this was. In this case, the disciples don't have to ask. They see who it is, but it happens in the course of the fellowship meal. Doesn't it make you wonder? The charcoal fire is in place. You can tell John was there. They bring in the fish, lay it on the fire with the bread, fresh fish, and then come and have breakfast. And he serves it. He takes the bread and gives it to them. And so with the fish. Why is he doing that? Weren't the meals normally an expression of fellowship? And isn't this a way of him acting as the host and of him telling them that even though circumstances have changed with his body and his physical presence with them, he still is with them. And does this mean anything to you and I when on a day when we have met to observe the Lord's Supper together? And to think about Jesus being with his people when two or three are gathered together in his name. I wonder if any of them complimented the cook. If any of them said thank you. If any of them tried to serve him. It's interesting to consider that. But the real lesson, I think, is this idea here. And that's what Jesus wants them to see. This part of the story is not unrelated to that first paragraph, in other words. The thought continues. Now, in the third place, Jesus taught in this breakfast meeting with these disciples that he is willing to allow people who love him humbly the opportunity to live up to their best intentions and to give them the privilege of being involved in his work This is a beautiful part of this story. And when I've heard discussions of John 21, verses 15 and following, they've almost always been preoccupied with the different words for love that are used, and sometimes the different words for know, you know that I love you, and so forth, that Peter uses here. And I'm not suggesting those terms are insignificant. I just don't think they're the point that's being made here. I want to take you back to Mark 14 for a second to ask you to notice here in verses 26 through 30 something that, or ask you to remember something you already know, but I think it has some bearing here. Mark 14, this is the night when when they're about to go to Gethsemane, when they're on their way. It says, when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, you will all fall away, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. But after I'm raised up, I'll go before you to Galilee. Might be what's happening in the passage we've been reading in John 21. And Peter said to him, even though they all fall away, I will not. And Jesus said to him, truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. But he said emphatically, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. They all said the same. Now think about that for a moment and come back with me to John 21. I want to ask you, how many times as I read this, does Jesus give Peter the opportunity to reaffirm that he really loves Christ? And even though Peter does so more humbly, he doesn't use the word for unselfish, committed, willful love, or seeking the best interest of the cause of the one love that agape would mean. He still affirms that he's the Lord's friend and he loves him like a brother. How many times? And then ask yourself whether this might have something to do with the reversal of those denials, where Peter said, even if they all forsake you, I won't. Now think of it this way. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? I've read the discussions. Was he talking about more than these fish and these biscuits? Or was he talking about more than James and John do, and more than Nathaniel does, and more than Thomas does? Or does it mean all of that together? I think it means more than these other guys, because But consider, over in that other passage, Peter said, even if they all forsake you, I won't. So it stands to reason that there's an implied comparison here. He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he'd said it to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Let me stop there for just a second and ask you if you notice what I've pointed out from Mark 14. Isn't it possible that Jesus is giving this man, humble though he was, an opportunity to reaffirm his love and to communicate to him that you're going to be given the opportunity to live up to that good intention. Notice what happens, verse 18. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And then John explains, this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. When Peter made his previous commitment that night on the way to Gethsemane, he failed to live up to his best intention. Jesus was predicting not merely how Peter was going to die, but that Peter's loyalty would not fail him the next time. This was a precious and important saying in that manner. And it was followed by his instruction to Peter, follow me. Which is what Peter had wanted to do before and what he had intended to do before the flesh failed him as it did. When Jesus told Peter, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my lambs, feed my sheep, he was speaking as the shepherd who had been smitten before when the sheep were scattered, including Peter. And he was giving Peter the reassurance that he was going to be trusted to be involved in doing what Jesus did, even to the point of giving up his life. It's interesting that in 1 Peter 5, in verses 1 through 4, Peter uses these same terms to talk to his fellow elders at that time about tending the flock of God, exercising the oversight willingly and not for any selfish reason. Something that the words originate here. All right, now the fourth thing that Jesus teaches in this place, two disciples who are turning their attention back to serving him and who are relying on his fellowship and provision and who are trying to live up to their best intentions, the Lord teaches them that while they're doing that, they need to keep their eyes on their own responsibility to follow him and to do his will. And they need to not get caught up in some sort of a misunderstanding that sidetracks them off into other things. Think about this now. As you notice, that statement about following him is taken by Peter, maybe for what it was. But he nervously says, what about him? All right, so thinking about this, the fourth one, the idea that now each disciple is to pay attention to his own obligation to follow the Lord and not to let a misunderstanding sidetrack him from that. This is John 21 now, verses 20 through 23. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John again, following them, the one who also had leaned back against him during the supper and said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? John's identifying himself for us there. When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Isn't there something human about that? When you feel like the attention is on you and your responsibility, you got to say, what about him? And to turn attention in that way. Jesus said to him, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. So the saying spread, this is how rumors start, by the way, the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. That is, that John was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? In this event, Jesus teaches Peter pretty straightforward words. You follow me. Whatever my will is for some other servant doesn't change what I just told you. You follow me. You feed my sheep. You love me like you've said you did. No matter what happens with somebody else. And then the other thing, it's interesting that one of the four Gospels in the New Testament has to take up place to correct what somebody said. There's something so practical with this. The word got around that Jesus had said John would never die. And it came just from not listening well enough and then getting off into some, how do you get from Peter, you follow me, to John will never die? That's how we are. And Jesus is trying to tell us to avoid that by focusing on and paying attention to our own obligation to him. I don't think Jesus taught anything different during the time between his resurrection and his ascension than he taught during his ministry already. He taught some of it in a more personal and in a clearer way, more vivid way. But the reason I've read this with you like I have tonight is to try to show it's the same thing he had already taught. He just wants to make sure that they don't forget it now that these great events have happened. You and I do well also to remember we have a mission. The Lord can provide for us while we're doing it if we will humbly love him and meet our personal responsibility to him. How about you? Is that how you're approaching things? If we can help you tonight, either to obey the gospel or if we can pray about something, let us know by coming while we stand and sing together.